Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming back. We are on part two of our series. Dan, there's some sheets over here. Legacy of Leaders, 10 Leadership Principles We Can Learn from Great Jewish Leaders. We're going to continue from last week. Each one of the classes is standalone. So today we're going to do Principle 3 and Principle 4. Let's jump straight in. We have a lot to do this evening. Principle 3 of our 10 Leadership Principles. And to fully appreciate this, we have to understand where the Jewish people were at this time to bring out the full impact of what we're going to see. Moshe Rabbeinu, had, if you remember from last week, we mentioned, had to run away after killing the Mitzri, the Egyptian, was attacking the Jewish man in Egypt. He was a very young boy in his teens. He left, and he was a shepherd. He did a number of things in between. Actually, the Midrash tells us he was actually a king and ruled over a certain area also for a short amount of time. So he had some leadership preparation. And we spoke as well last week, if you remember, those who were here, how the fact that Moses grew up in the palace of Pharaoh also had a major impact because he was around leadership. Having said that, his big moment came. And he was standing, if you remember, you may have read the book, you may have seen the film, by a burning bush. And this bush was burning with a great fire, but what was unusual about it, anybody remember? It was not being consumed. It was not being burned down. And as we know, vegetation is on fire, it ends up burning down. Here, it did not. Just for interest, why was that image to use? Why did God use that particular image as opposed to anything else? Why not a burning man, which is big in America, or I don't know. I just thought of that. Could have used anything. Could use a candy truck. I don't know, ice cream. So the commentator is actually quite interested with this. What is the idea of that imagery? So one thing I read on this was that, first of all, it's alive. It's vegetation. Low-lying vegetation, which represents the Jewish people who were alive, on fire. And he was being told that the rest of his people, who remember, he had already connected to many years before, were on fire, but they were not being consumed. This wasn't a wasted mission. Things were bad. Things were really, really bad for the Jews in Egypt, but they weren't being destroyed because of it. And that was this particular metaphor, this image, which he was shown. And he was told by God to go in to Egypt and rescue the Jewish people. And if you remember last week, he also said that he didn't want to go in. He actually argued with God for quite a while. He wanted his older brother Aaron to be the one, thanks for remembering that, to be the one to rescue the Jewish people. He said, who am I? I've been out of it for so long. And I don't speak well. I have a lisp, remember. I'm not a great orator. We'll speak about that a little bit later, actually. And God said, it's your job. You have to go do it. And eventually, he does. Let's have a look at some of the verses. Something interesting over here. In the book of Shemot, book of Exodus chapter 3, verse 9 through 10. And now behold, the outcry of the children of Israel has come to me. This is God speaking. And I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Now go, take my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Pesach is coming in a few days. Perfect timing. Let my people go. Where to? What was the whole concept of getting the Jewish people out of Egypt? And the idea was to get them into the land of milk and honey. That's right. Into the land of Israel. And he was actually given a double challenge. Number one, he had to persuade the Egyptians to let the Jewish people go. As in the famous expression, let my people go. But most people don't realize there was actually another part to this whole mission which was much, much harder. You don't know what it was? Well, I should write it out for you. To persuade the Israelites to take the risk of going. That took a little bit more. Because when it came to persuading the Egyptians, there were plagues. And there was... But to deal with Jews, not easy. We're going to talk about the only way the Jewish people are described in the Torah a little bit later. So get ready for that. That'll be in about 10 minutes or so. It was not an easy task to do. The latter turned out to be much more difficult than the former. And so we've reached our first or third principle, first for the evening. Leadership is about the future. It's vision-driven. Any great leader we see in Jewish history is always thinking about the future. Things may look good now. Things may not look good now. Things that don't look good now could become good. And things that look fantastic now, I think, may end up not being good in the future. There is an expression in Judaism for this. And by the way, we're not talking about prophecy. Moses was a prophet. Okay, we're not talking about prophecy over here. Okay, the Jewish people are no longer a prophet organization. We know that. At that point, we were. But that's not the point I want to describe with you. Over here, we're describing people who are able to look at the facts on the ground and make a prediction, work on all the information they can gather, and talk about the future. It's a vision of the future that we're looking to. Moses had that ability. He understood, which is why he rose to the challenge of going in to Egypt to take the Jewish people out of Egypt in order to get them into the land of Israel, which he actually personally did not make it into, by looking into the future. And the expression is a person, roe et hanolad. To roe is to see hanolad, that which has not actually risen yet. That which hasn't occurred. It's considered to be one of the five great traits in Judaism. It says in chapter 2 of Pirkei Avot, a person has the ability to look at all the information and see the future. It's a skill. That is what we're going to focus on this evening. Moses had an older sister. Her name was Miriam, right? And Miriam, we're told, was a very, very great and holy woman. And she had a very similar ability. It goes right back to when she was a child. I believe she was less than 10 years old when the following incident happened. Look at the great ability of Miriam to look into the future. The children of Israel were broken by the torture and by back-breaking work of the Egyptians. The Egyptians enslaved the children of Israel with crushing harshness. This is the beginning of the exile, by the way. This is right when things were starting to get bad for the Jewish people. By the way, it always starts the same way. The Jews arrive, everything is challenging, then it gets fantastic, we make a lot of money, then they hate us, they want to kick us out. Same theme. Right now, it's the beginning of the difficulty. They embittered their lives, says the book of Exodus, with hard work, with mortar, with bricks. And we eat the haroset on Pesach in a few days to remember that. And with every labor of the field, and all their labors were crushing harshness. It was crushing physically and morally and spiritually. It was a terrible time. Miriam was a midwife, and she was commanded to kill Jewish baby boys. That's what she was told to do. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, when you help the women deliver, if it's a son, kill them. If it's a girl, let them live. But the midwives, of which Miriam was one of them, feared God, says the Torah, and did not do as the king of Egypt had said. Basically, he wanted to kill out all the Jewish boys. Why? Because through his astrological powers, he had discovered that a savior, a male savior, was going to come to the Jewish people. And he was nervous about that. So he gave the command to the midwives. Midwives, because they'd be operating with the baby, people wouldn't see it, obviously, they wouldn't get suspicious. At this point, he wasn't worried about that, to kill the baby boys. Leave the Jewish girls alive, because then our Egyptian men can marry these Jewish girls. So he wasn't worried about the girls. He says, kill the boys. Did they do it? Absolutely not. So instead, the king chooses infanticide. Kill all the Jewish baby boys by throwing them into the Nile. As it says in the book of Shemot, Exodus chapter 1, verse 22, Pharaoh commanded his entire people. He's got everyone involved now. Every son that will be born into the river, you shall throw him, and every daughter you shall keep alive. That's the command he gives. Now, check this out. It seems like we're going to left field, but we're going to connect it. Right afterwards, it says the following in the next chapter. A man went from the house of Levi and took from the daughter of Levi the woman conceived and gave birth to a son. Now, they got married. There wasn't really marriage in those days as we know it. There were chuppahs. People just basically just met up and lived together and had kids, which they actually do now. But we'll leave that aside. They kind of like got together. Who was this man? We're not told who this man, this son of Levi, and the daughter of Levi were. The Talmud tells us this was actually Yocheved and Amram. Anyone know who Yocheved and Amram were? Who was Yocheved? Moses' mother. By the way, what's the Name of Jesus' mother? Mary. Name of Moses' mother? Yeah, it's a bit of a problem. Yeah. Okay, we'll leave that aside. So the parents... It's a shame then, right? The parents of Miriam and Aaron had decided to separate. Why do they want to separate? Because they said, listen, we can't be living together and having babies still, because we're going to have a baby boy, let's say, and is doomed to death. So they actually separated. Came along Miriam, their young daughter, and said, you're doing a terrible thing. You're actually worse than Pharaoh, mum and dad. Why? Because Pharaoh just wants to kill the boys. You, by not having kids, are also stopping females coming to the world. And they agreed, and they remarried. And they remarried. And that actually is the man from the house of Levi who took the daughter from Levi. There was actually a remarriage, and they got married again. They already had Miriam and Aaron, and now they had a young baby boy whose name was... No, it wasn't Moses. It was Tuvia, who ended up becoming Moses. Moses was the name he received when, remember, the daughter of Pharaoh pulled him in from the water. We'll discuss the daughter of Pharaoh a little bit later. A very extraordinary individual, by the way, this young lady, this young woman, and what she did. She had the ability, and we see it over here at a very young age. She persuades her parents to remarry and to have more kids. And now people are like, you're crazy having kids in this condition? We're in the middle of a war. They're killing us. They're taking baby boys and throwing them in the water. Let's say we have a baby boy. You're dooming him to death. She's like, you've got to see the future. And through her own personal vision, she was able to actually bring out from her parents the future savior of the entire Jewish people who was to become Moses, yes. Become Moshe Rabbeinu. This trait of hers carries on later in life. Let's have a look at another incident. And these are things we kind of may have heard of, read, but we don't go into them. And you see some beautiful concepts over here. Miriam and her visionary future, a great Jewish leader. Many years later, when the Jewish people leave Egypt and the sea had split for them, the Torah says the following. We're back in the book of Shemot, Exodus. It is Pesach. Miriam, the prophetess, sister of Aaron, at this point she was a prophetess, took the drum in her hand. And all the women went forth with her with drums and with dances. Miriam, Moses' older sister, is a musician. And she gets all the Jewish women to sing and dance. Why are they singing and dancing? Because they've had amazing miracles that were done for them. The sea split. The Egyptians were wiped out. They took out their musical instruments and they're dancing. Now you read that on face value, you think that's very, very nice. Musical instruments. Interesting, it doesn't say the men had musical instruments. And that's what you've got with you. You just got out of Egypt. And you're grabbing your stuff to leave. You didn't have time. You didn't allow the bread to rise on your back. So you had to eat matzah. Matzah means a lot more than that, but we'll leave that aside for now. And now, you have musical instruments at hand? Isn't that weird? Like, oh yeah. Bread? No time. Guitar, drums, harps, right? Load them up. Put them on the back of the car. Yeah, let's get them out of Egypt. Yeah. Yeah, up there, put it up there. Put the drum set in there. What's going on? This is a question that's asked by the commentators. And the Mechilta says something unbelievable. Why does the Torah need to even mention these musical instruments? It says something unbelievable about Miriam, actually all the Jewish women that left Egypt. And according to the Jewish sources, the reason the Jewish men got to get out was because of the great merit of the holy Jewish women. It says the women had greater faith than the men, that they would be an eventual redemption. This is why they, not the men, had taken musical instruments with them out of Egypt in preparation for that moment. Miriam knew what was going to happen. She saw everything around her. She perceived. She was Ro'as HaNolad. What? It was going to come forward. And she says, we are going to need musical instruments. There's going to be a big celebration in the Sinai Desert. We're going to have a bonfire. We're going to dance around. And I am going to be part of that. And I want to make sure we're all there. And so she takes her musical instruments with her. And they all dance and sing. It sounds like a small incident. But it's actually teaching us something incredible about this wonderful woman and her vision for the future. Let's jump forward in time to another atrocity that was perpetrated against our people during the Second World War. And I want to pick on one person which no one here has even heard of, but is considered to be one of the great Jewish leaders. And his name is Rav Kahaneman. And he's famous because he built a yeshiva called Ponovich. Which, anyone heard of Ponovich? I guess you can call it like the Harvard, Yale of the yeshiva world, the Oxford, Cambridge, you know, like it is like up there. But how it was built is fascinating. A really incredible story. He planned to open the yeshiva in Israel because partly he wanted to save students in Europe. So the Ponovich Rav originally purchased a small hill in Bnei Brak, in a neighborhood called Zichron Meir neighborhood, where he was going to put up his yeshiva. Okay? And really what he wanted to do was thinking about his students in Europe and how he wanted to get them out and save them and keep Jewry going. In the summer of 1941, Nazi forces started to move into the Middle East, okay, under General Rommel. And they wanted to conquer Egypt, and eventually the plan was to literally wipe right through the Middle East. And of course that includes Israel soon after Egypt. It was so bad at that time, by the way, that the British that were in Palestine at the time were even sending home many of their families. And the country's Arabs were collaborating, many of them, and very excited about these German murderers who were coming through. There were two brothers. They were members of a very wealthy family, the Solomon family in a city called Kovno, who came to the Ponovich Rav, and they said, listen, I know you want to build this yeshiva, but the Nazis are coming. This is not a good time to build this yeshiva. And Rommel is going to come through and he's going to kill us. This is not a time to stop building buildings. There's time for building buildings. There's time for hiding, preparing for war. So the story goes that he listened to them very, very carefully and in a very serious way. He thought about the situation that was facing him. The Nazis about to come into Israel. But very quickly, he said the following. He said, how long do you think we have before these Nazis can make it into Israel? So they said, the way they reckon it, about 10 days. That's how close they were to the Nazis coming in. 10 days. He answered quickly and said, then we have 10 days of building. 10 days of building. And that's what he did. He spent those 10 days building. Thank God eventually the Nazis did not make it into the land. And he built his yeshiva. And that small idea at a crazy time, which is on par with the destruction of the Jews in Egypt, here we're facing the Nazis. He's like, this is not a time to, this is time to buy. This is not a time to sell. And he bought, and he built, and he is considered in this recent generation, one of the great people who's Roeh et HaNolad. Things are bad now. We have to plan for the future because they will get better. The Jewish people are described in one way in the entire Torah. There's one description of us as a nation. There are various traits that various people have in the Torah. Abraham is chesed, you know, and we have various great teachers and tzaddik, righteous people. But there's only one way that us as a nation, and that includes everyone here because you're part of the Jewish nation, are described in the Torah. Anyone know the only way we describe the entire Torah? When you hear this, by the way, it should resonate with you. It should resonate with you. Let's have a look aside. Hashem said to Moses, say to the children of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. Kishay Oref. Stiff neck. What's stiff neck? We're like, don't put enough gel. We're not like stretching enough. Not doing enough yoga. What is that? How can that be a trait? How can that be a trait? So the commentators say, I need that.
There's something wrong with this microphone.
Okay, should have tested it, no problem.
It was fine, and then it just started getting really staticky.
Thanks. Okay. What is stiff-necked? What is this idea of Kishay Oref? So the idea is we are a stubborn people. Extremely stubborn. Is that a compliment or an insult, by the way? Compliment or insult? It's what? It's both. Give me an example of both then. Give me an example of how it could be a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, you'd be stubborn that you might continue to persist in something despite something bad coming your way. You could also continue to persist and that could be a negative thing.
Have you seen our people, how we seem to be focused on something? And no matter how focused we are on doing the wrong thing, and you want to bring them back and say, you're doing the wrong thing, we're like, I'm not listening to you. Or when sometimes we're on the right path, and we know we're doing the right thing, and people want to push us away, we are stubborn, like the Maccabees at Hanukkah, for example. There's always this stubborn element among our people. Every trait has a positive and a negative. We are the stiff-necked people. We are stubborn, we stick at it, and through that, we build at times when everyone else is crashing down. And that helps us look into the future. Let's jump forward in history about 35 years or so. And I want to talk about someone who I'm actually a great fan of. A great fan of. And his name, I hope you've heard of him. Funny, I give this talk, and I mention this guy's name, and a lot of Russians even haven't heard of him. Anyone heard of Anatoly Sharansky, Natan Sharansky? I hope you've heard of him. He's a very, very holy and special Jew. I have not met him. I've met a lot of famous people in the Jewish world, but I'm looking forward to one day. I want to tell you a story. I read his book many years ago called Fear No Evil. It's really worth reading. It's an incredible story. And basically, he was arrested in 1977 on charges of spying for the United States and treason. By the way, just so you know, his real crime was teaching Hebrew to other Russians and teaching Torah, which he loved, in forests. That's where he would go, and eventually they caught him on sedition, and they sentenced him to 13 years of forced labor in a Siberian labor camp, a gulag. Okay? I want to read to you something he wrote, which really sums up what exactly this third principle of leadership we're talking about. And he really is a great Jewish leader, head of the Jewish Agency right now. Right as he was, it's a very sad story actually, at this point anyway, right when he was sentenced at his quote-unquote trial, his wife had just managed to leave and make way to Israel. He'd got married days before. He was in the first week of his marriage, and now he was separated from his wife, and he was told he was going to go into forced labor for 13 years. Okay, so you can only imagine what was going through his mind. And the Russians offered him a deal. They offered him that if he gave up his fellow Jewish activists, of which he was considered one of the leaders, they would reduce his trial greatly. And he said no. And before they led him away, it was a close court, obviously. Before they led him away, he gave the following speech, which he managed just to write down, and he remembered and put down in his book. And I want to read you his words. They're very, very powerful. He says, from the start of my investigation, the KGB told me often that given my position with regard to this case, I would receive either capital punishment or, at best, 15 years of imprisonment. They promised that if I changed my mind and cooperated with them in their struggle against Jewish activities, I would receive a short symbolic sentence and the opportunity to visit my wife in Israel. But I did not change my position. 5 years ago, he just wanted to get out, by the way, I applied for an exit visa to emigrate from the USSR to Israel. Today, I am further from my goal. This would seem, he says, to be a cause of regret, but this is not the case. These 5 years that he was a Jewish activist were the best of my life. I am happy to have lived them honestly and at peace with my conscience. I have said only what I have believed, and I have not violated my conscience. Extremely conscientious individual, strong sense of conscience and purpose. I feel part of a marvelous historical process. At this point, he didn't realize what his freedom eventually was going to lead to was the whole fall of the Soviet Empire. Because Ronald Reagan got involved, and his wife got involved, and it all ended up becoming Gorbachev, you know, this whole turned the wall down, remember the whole thing, right? He was the one who really got that ball rolling. But he says, I feel part of a marvelous historical process, the national revival of Soviet Jewry, and its return to the homeland, to Israel and Brooklyn. My relative, he didn't say that, I'm just saying. My relatives know how strong my desire was to join my wife in Israel, and with what joy at any moment to exchange my so-called fame as a Jewish activist for a visa to Israel. Listen to his words. Perfect for Pesach. Read this at your Pesach table. For 2,000 years, the Jewish people, my people, have been dispersed all over the world and seemingly deprived of any hope of returning. But still each year, Jews have stubbornly, there's that word, and apparently without reason, said to each other, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. He's following in the footsteps, I believe, in my humble and personal opinion, of the Ponovitch Rav, of Miriam, of Moses, and other great leaders, that right now, things are absolutely terrible. And many people would cave in. But it's actually at that moment, when things get really, really bad, that a vision of the future comes to certain people. And we've all, at this stage of your life, hopefully all of you, have experienced terrible things that at that moment you've looked at and said, I think there is something amazing that can come out of this. That is a leadership quality which we all must inculcate. And by the way, that is a story of the entire Jewish people. Okay? We always say, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. Let us jump to principle four. Principle four of our 10 principles of great Jewish leaders. And principle four is pretty simple, actually. Pretty simple. And we here at the JC are big fans of it. And what is that? Leaders learn. And they don't stop learning. They don't just go to school, graduate, and just... And even those great leaders, those business leaders who always say, I dropped out of college, right? I think Steve Jobs and such people, they're always very quick to say, but I promise you, they learn and they study and they read a vast amount. They may not have a quote-unquote formal education, but they have an informal education. And that is principle number four. Leaders study more than others do. They read more than others do. I want to stop for one second. I looked this up. On average, your average U.S. citizen reads how many books every year? How many books does your average U.S. citizen, America, we're not talking Uganda, right? We're not talking Nigeria, where maybe books and libraries are not so easy to, and I'm maybe not including Facebook status updates as being reading. I want a statistic percentage of how many books your average U.S. citizen reads every single year. I by age, I haven't got it. I don't know. Let's just say post-college. Three? Wow. Oh, my God. You're more pessimistic than I was. 1.3, wasn't it? They read the first book. They get through the third way. Forget that. This whole reading thing. They stop and finish it. Really? Wow. Well, yeah, you're pretty much out. I read different. I think Pew Research Center said it was like four or five. Four or five. Okay, we'll leave. Okay, I don't know. I may have to look at it. I'm assuming students, we assume, read much less. The rest of us are going to read. Is that shocking? Like, the entire year? I mean, my kids read more than that, you know? Run, spot, run. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I was quite shocked by that. You may have realized that we Jews are big readers and big studies. Actually, in many cultures, the Jewish people are referred to, sometimes not a nice way. I think Islam and the Quran, if I remember, describe us as donkeys with books on our backs. So even those who sometimes want to denigrate us, admit that we're carrying a lot of books and we're reading a vast amount. It's a very, very Jewish thing. It goes right back. Let's talk about one of the leadership positions among the Jewish people. And one of the leadership positions, which is actually not such a pleasant job, it seems it on the surface, but it isn't, is king of the Jewish people. This is difficult, but there's a specific set of laws of mitzvot that are exclusively and only for kings. You know that? We don't have them, they do. And some of them involve curtailing their power. They can't have too much power. They can't own too many horses. They can't have too many wives. They can't do many things that maybe we would or maybe wouldn't be allowed to do anyway. Right? None of it's holding their power back. But there's one thing which is unusual, which only a king has to do. And it says in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 17, this is the fifth book of the five books of Moses, it must be that when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, this is the king, he shall write for himself two copies of the Torah. Every king has to have two copies of the Torah. It must always be with him. And he shall read it from it all the days of his life. So God is talking to the king. And is like, you could be the most powerful conqueror, warm, you can in the entire world, but you've got to write a Torah. Not only have you got to write it, you've got to keep it with you all the time. Now, when I heard this, I was always surprised by that. How do you keep a Torah with you the entire time? So I actually looked into this. Different opinions, what that actually means. It's just interesting. There is one opinion that he literally carried a Torah with him. Like walking around. Walking around, Torah in his hand. There's another opinion, was like probably scrolls. Another opinion was that his entourage. Someone, you know, was like, he's got his like entourage, his peeps or like going with him, you know, walking around with him. So it would actually, one of them would actually carry Torah. I read something fascinating. Ari Kaplan, a great Jewish thinker who died in the 80s, he says, have you seen those micro writings? You know, it's like in Sfat, they always said it's like micro writing things. So he says that is a skill that goes right back in Jewish history. Right? It's very small Hebrew letters. And it used to be that it was expensive to make parchment. So there is an opinion that they would actually write a small Torah, yay big. And he would wear it around his neck on a chain, like Jewish bling. Just walking, imagine that? I would love that, by the way. I would love that. Just as a side point, as a side point. I always wondered why that would help. Why is it going to help him? I mean, the learning aspect is one thing, but why would carrying with him all the time help? Just say he's got to read a Torah, you know, all that, but he's got to carry with him all the time. Why would that even help? You know? So someone told me the following story, and I think it's very true, about an individual who had to transfer a Torah from, I think it was from Israel to America or the other way around. And it was a young guy, and he was holding a Torah. And he's like, couldn't put it in his luggage. It's not respectful for a Torah. You've got to carry it with you and have it wrapped up. So he's walking around the airport with his Torah. And he sits next to this young lady, who maybe he should have been talking to. And he's like, oh, that's lovely. You know, Christina is sitting next to him in the airport. And he's like, hey, how you doing? Where are you from? He's like, oh, I'm holding a Torah. I'm like, schmoozing with this girl, talking like, I don't feel good about it. He's like, I'm sorry, I have to leave. And he gets on the phone, he's talking to his mother, he gets into an argument with her. He's like, how can I argue with my mother? I'm holding a Torah in my hand. Same to, you know, for good. Right? And he goes to the store and he sees something there and he returns and he found that his behavior improved dramatically because he was carrying this Torah with him all the time. This is not a command for us. I don't want to see any of you walking around Manhattan, right, carrying Torahs with you tomorrow. Maybe a chumash in your hand is fine, but not a Torah around with you. The king has to, though. The king needs it. Because in the writing of the Torah is direction. Side point. However, the king has to know that he has to read from it all the time. Who took over from Moses? Anybody know? Who got the job? Yoshua. Why did Yoshua get the job? Did Moses have any children? Did Moses have children? Yes! Two sons. They could have taken over the job. Right? Don't we see when dictators die? Right? King Jong-il, his little like nut child, takes over. It's always like someone like Meshuggah take over the one who comes before. Isn't that like always the way? It's always like a kid or an uncle or a cousin or a nephew or something. It's always, one dictator's always got someone else there. Actually, the person who took over was someone non-related to him, not even the same tribe, actually. And his name was Yoshua. Listen to this amazing individual. I actually wrote an essay for a book that was published because I was obsessed with Joshua and the conquest of the land of Israel. And Yoshua is considered to be one of the great military leaders of Jewish history. But as well as that, he was a very learned person, very, very well read. And listen to this story. It says, and Rashi asked that question in the book of Pirkei Avot, why was Yoshua chosen to be Moses' legacy? Why would he get the job? Why were Elazar, Pinchas, or the 70 sages not chosen? They also had great prophecy. These were great individuals. Why did he get the job? This is an amazing answer. Rashi responds by saying, I'll tell you why. Because Joshua had one job which he did very, very well. He was the first one into the study hall, and he was the last one to leave. He would come early, and he would make sure that all the chairs, or in those days probably cushions they would lie on, in the tent were there, and everything was nice and neat and orderly and clean. And when everyone left, all the sages left, I'm sure there were, I don't know, like candy wrappers on the floor, you know, like, you know, Twizzler packets, you know, which Joshua had to deal with. All the sages were like, you know, pigging out. So he's like, no, can't leave it like this. This is the tent of learning, the tent of study. And he would tidy up after everyone else had left. Says Judaism, he gets the job. He's a keen student that wants to learn. And he's the one who gets to take the entire Jewish people into the land of Israel. By the way, that was a great time in Jewish history. A great, great time. He was an eager student. By the way, it didn't say he was the brightest. It doesn't say that he was the most devoted to his master Moses. And he had the most respect for the idea of Jewish learning. Now, check out this story. This is unbelievable. The book of Joshua describes all the battles among it and the division of the land of Israel that the Jewish people had to take. So it says at the beginning of the book that Joshua was told to keep this book of the law always on his lips, meditate on it day and night, similar to any other king. Remember, kings are told to learn. Kings study. Every leader has to study and learn. So Joshua was about to conquer a certain city in Israel called Jericho, Jericho. And the night before a battle, what do you think most people are doing? Now remember, he's a general. He's not sending his people in there. He's out there. He's fighting with them. He's involved. What does Joshua do? He's practicing for battle. He's swinging his sword around. He's stretching. The guys are pumped up. He's telling them to get ready for the battle. We're going into Jericho. We're going to overtake it. Now eventually it's overtaken in a very, very miraculous fashion. But at this point, they were not aware of that. They thought this was going to be, by the way, the other battles were physical. But you would have thought that they would have been ready for this big battle. They were getting stretching, and that's exactly what Joshua was doing. And it says it happened when Joshua was in Jericho, that he raised his eyes and saw, and behold, a man was standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. Who was this man that the book of Joshua says that Joshua saw? It was an angel in the form of a man. That's how great he was. He got to see angels in physical form. And it was actually, says Rashi, the angel Michael, who is the angelic protector of Israel. Now, is that a good sign or a bad sign? You're standing there. You're about to take the Jewish people into the land of Israel. You're about to overtake, which God told you to do. You're about to take the city of Jericho. Everyone's ready. You got your sword out. And then in front of you is an angel with his sword up in his hand. Good sign or bad sign?
Good
sight. You're a Thor, right? He's there. It's not good. You don't want angels with swords in their hands facing you. He made a terrible, terrible mistake. Says the Talmud in the Tractate of Megillah, by facing him with his sword, he was saying that Joshua was worthy of punishment. He did a terrible thing. What'd he do? He just arrived. We just got here. What mistake has he made? Unbelievable idea. Because he had spent the night practicing and preparing for war, instead of doing what? Rather than studying Torah, in which he would have the merit to win the war. One second. I better go to battle. We're dealing with all these seven nations in the land of Israel. They want to kill us. That's not us. Even, well, this is Joshua. Even at that point, leadership means learning, study, understanding. The battle will be won or lost by our soldiers. But you as the leader have to lead by example. Just like the king, just like Moses. And our tool that we have is that we study. And this is a tool which modern leaders know. Modern leaders, I spoke to my good friend of mine who owns a business here. He says he goes to these like seminars for leaders. And he says it's a known thing. Leaders read. And they read and they read 200 books a year. Crazy amount. Voracious readers. The more you read, the more you learn, the better your leadership is. And by the way, this isn't just a religious thing, as we're saying. Even secular leadership. William Gladstone had a library of more than 30,000 books. And he read, they say, 20,000 of them. 10,000 just look good on the shelf, right? Gladstone and Benjamin Disraeli were both prolific writers. Winston Churchill wrote 50 books and won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he was a war leader, right? This is a war leader. Yet he's writing and he's writing and he's writing, and he wins the Nobel Prize for Literature. That says something about his level of leadership. Right? You visit David Ben-Gurion's house, we mentioned a little bit last week in Tel Aviv, and he also, whether you agree with him or not, and all his philosophies, he had thousands of books. His museum is basically shelves and shelves and shelves of books. We're going to discuss next class someone I'm a great fan of as well, Menachem Begin. A great individual. I read his books too. He also wrote some books. And he was a master of Roman history. And he read and he read. And a lot of his writings and thoughts that he put together were based upon early Zionist teachings and a lot of learning. Study makes the difference between the statesman and the politician, between the transformative leader and just the manager. If you're learning, you are leading. We're going to stop over there. And we will pick this up, God willing, after the holiday of Passover. And we'll pick up with our part three. Have a wonderful, freeing Passover Pesach holiday.